Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're looking into a really fascinating period, drawing from quite a few sources on a major dynasty in the medieval Near East, the Ayyubids. Our aim is to trace how they came to power, understand their impact, and maybe figure out why their story still resonates today.
Absolutely. This era, the 12th and 13th centuries, it was just incredibly dynamic. You've got this complex web of shifting powers, and the Crusader states are a constant factor. The Ayyubids, they emerge right in the middle of this and fundamentally change the game. And it's particularly interesting, as you mentioned, how their family origins connect back to the Kurdish people.
Right. So let's set the scene a bit. What did the political map look like in the mid-12th century?
Well, you had the Fatimid Caliphate in Egypt, once very powerful Shia rulers. But by this time, our sources show they were really in decline. Think, internal power struggles, economic problems. Their authority was seriously weakened.
And that weakness in Egypt, which was such a vital and wealthy region, that created an opening, didn't it? Meanwhile, up in Syria and Upper Mesopotamia, the Sunni Zengids were gaining strength. Nur al-Din was a key figure there, right? Aiming to unify Muslim lands against the Crusaders.
Exactly. Nur al-Din sees this vulnerability in Egypt as a major opportunity. He wants to expand, partly for strategic reasons, but also he was deeply committed to a Sunni revival, bringing Egypt back into the Sunni fold. This drive really sets the stage for the Ayyubid family's rise.
Okay, so where do the Ayyubids themselves fit in? The story usually starts with two brothers, Najm al-Din Ayyub and Asad al-Din Shirku. Sources trace their family's Kurdish roots back to Drivan in medieval Armenia. They were military commanders serving the Zengids.
Precisely. Their careers show how patronage worked then. Talent and loyalty got you noticed. Ayyub held governorships, important ones like Baalbek and Damascus under Nur al-Din. Shirku, his brother, he was a top general. He's the one leading those crucial Zengid campaigns into Egypt. Their service really paved the way for the next generation.
And that generation is spearheaded by Najm al-Din's son, Salah ad-Din Yusuf ibn Ayyub, better known to history, of course, as Saladin, born near Tikrit, modern Iraq, around 1137 or 38, grows up in Zengid cities like Damascus, involved in military life from early on, but apparently also had an interest in religious studies.
Right. His upbringing is entirely within that Zengid sphere. He absorbs their focus on Sunni orthodoxy, the concept of jihad against the Crusaders, military discipline. Mm-hmm. These become absolutely central to his own rule later.
So the big opportunity comes with those Zengid campaigns into Egypt between 1164 and 1169. Shirku is leading them. Saladin's learning the ropes under his uncle. And it's complicated, right? Not just Zengids versus Fatimids, but Crusaders involved too. Different Fatimid factions.
Very messy. But Shirku eventually gets himself appointed vizier in Cairo in 1169. Then suddenly he dies just months later. And surprisingly, the Fatimid caliph picks Saladin, who's still relatively young, to take over as vizier.
That seems unexpected. Why Saladin? Did the caliph think he'd be easy to control?
Sources debate it. Maybe. Mm. But Saladin proves to be incredibly astute. He's a Sunni vizier in a Shia state, and he just methodically starts consolidating his own power, undermining the Fatimid military structure, placing his own family and loyal commanders in key posts.
It's a gradual takeover from within, and this culminates in 1171 when he formally abolishes the Fatimid caliphate. He declares Egypt's allegiance back to the Sunni Abbasid caliph in Baghdad.
A huge moment. Egypt, with all its wealth and strategic importance, now becomes the core of Ayyubid power. And from this secure base, Saladin can pursue his larger ambition, uniting the Muslim Near East against the Crusaders.
So with Egypt under his belt, he starts expanding. Nur al-Din dies in 1174, and Saladin sees his chance to claim leadership in Syria. He enters Damascus peacefully that same year.
Mm-hmm. Then he campaigns to bring other key Syrian cities, like Hama and Homs, under his authority. He has to fight off rivals, other Zengid lords, defeating them at the Battle of the Horns of Hama in 1175. His power grows, and crucially, the Abbasid caliph in Baghdad recognizes him, granting him the title Sultan of Egypt and Syria. That legitimacy is vital.
And his reach extends further, doesn't it? His forces conquer Yemen, securing Red Sea trade routes. Ayyubid influence stretches to the Hejaz, parts of North Africa, all aimed at building that united front.
It really is a masterclass in combining military force, diplomacy. He married Nur al-Din's widow, for instance, securing that caliphal legitimacy and, importantly, cultivating this image. His reputation for justice, generosity, chivalry. His biographers helped promote this, making it easier for cities like Damascus to accept his rule.
Okay, let's talk about the kind of state he built. sources often describe it not as a centralized empire, but more like a family confederation. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's decentralized. Saladin assigned territories, Egypt, Damascus, Aleppo, etc., as semi-autonomous fiefdoms, Ika, to his sons, brothers, key commanders. They ruled their areas and provided military support in return.
That sounds like a way to manage a large realm, but maybe one with built-in problems down the line.
Exactly. It helps with administration and loyalty initially, but it definitely sows the seeds of future fragmentation. These regional rulers have their own power bases. Still, Egypt always remained the wealthiest and most powerful core. Cairo was the main capital.
And administratively, they kept much of the Fatimid bureaucracy in Egypt, but the military officials held the real power.
Pretty much. The sophisticated admin systems were kept, but military commanders were ultimately in charge. The army was everything. Initially a mix of Kurdish and Turkish cavalry, but increasingly Mamluks became absolutely central.
These are the slave soldiers, yeah. Right? Primarily Kipchak Turks, bought and trained as elite warriors, fiercely loyal to their specific patron.
Yes. The Ika system funded this military aristocracy. It gave Saladin a powerful, skilled fighting force, but it also concentrated immense military power in the hands of this distinct Mamluk elite, a potentially dangerous situation long term.
Oh, Hannah the chai lady is here, Roach Bosch Hannah. Ah, perfect timing. Let's grab some chai. How's it today? Is it good?
This is warming. A little bitter, perhaps. Could use just a touch more sugar, I think.
Agreed. Still, nothing like a good cup of chai to keep us going.
Absolutely. Ready to get back to the story.
Okay, time to get back to it. So Saladin has built this united front. This obviously sets the stage for a major confrontation with the Crusaders. And their own internal divisions really played into his hands, didn't they? The big clash comes at Hattin in 1187.
Yeah, Hattin, near Lake Tiberias. It was an utter catastrophe for the main Crusader army. They were lured out, exhausted by heat and thirst, made critical tactical mistakes. Saladin's forces just crushed them on July 4th, 1187. That victory effectively destroyed the military capacity of the Kingdom of Jerusalem.
And led to this amazingly fast capture of Crusader territories. Key cities like Acre, Jaffa, and the ultimate prize, Jerusalem itself, surrendered on October 2nd, 1187, after 88 years of Crusader rule.
And Saladin's treatment of Jerusalem's inhabitants stands out. Unlike the Crusader conquest in 1099, he allowed them to ransom themselves. This really boosted his reputation for magnanimity, even in Europe. The whole campaign after Hattin was a direct result of that Muslim unity he'd forged, facing a fragmented Crusader kingdom.
The fall of Jerusalem naturally caused panic in Europe and led to the Third Crusade. Big names involved. Richard the Lionheart, Philip Augustus of France.
A massive response. The Crusaders did manage to take back Acre after a very long siege, though Richard rather infamously massacred Muslim prisoners there afterwards. But despite Richard's military reputation, they couldn't retake Jerusalem. Saladin's forces, though strained, fought them to a standstill, essentially.
Which leads to the Treaty of Ramla in 1192. What did that settle?
It was a pragmatic truce. Jerusalem remained under Muslim control, but Christian pilgrims were guaranteed access. The Crusaders kept a narrow coastal strip. It basically reflected the reality that neither side could fully defeat the other at that moment. Saladin had secured the interior. The Crusaders held onto key ports.
Saladin dies not long after, in Damascus in 1193. His legacy is obviously immense. Revered in the Muslim world, respected even by opponents.
Yes, though, as we noted, that image was also carefully constructed. But beyond the edge, a key part of his policy was vigorously promoting Sunni Islam. He founded numerous madrasas, Islamic colleges, especially in Cairo and Damascus, to train a loyal Sunni scholarly and administrative class, counteracting the Fatimid Shia past.
And Al-Azhar in Cairo gets transformed under the Ayyubids too, right? From a Shia center to a major Sunni institution.
Absolutely. He also founded hospitals, began work on major projects like the Cairo Citadel. He really fostered this vibrant intellectual and cultural environment alongside the military campaigns. Cairo particularly flourished.
So unified Egypt and Syria, rolled back the Crusaders, fostered Sunni Islam and culture, a huge impact.
Definitely. But his death immediately exposed the weakness in that family confederation system he'd set up.
Right. The empire gets divided among his sons and brother Al-Adil. And predictably, infighting breaks out almost immediately.
It does. But Saladin's brother, Al-Adil Sorist, proves very capable. He skillfully navigates the rivalries, and by 1200, he manages to sideline Saladin's sons and reunite much of the empire under his own rule.
But then he continues the same practice, doesn't he? Assigning territories to his own sons.
Exactly. He provides stability for a time, ruling until 1218, but he perpetuates the underlying structural issue. His son, Al-Kamil, takes over and faces both internal Ayyubid rivals and external threats, like the Fifth Crusade, which directly targets Egypt.
Al-Kamil manages to defeat the Fifth Crusade, famously trapping them at Mansura in 1221. But then comes his handling of the Sixth Crusade under Emperor Frederick II. That's the controversial one.
Yes, the Treaty of Jaffa in 1229. Al-Kamil was dealing with fierce rivalry from his own brother in Damascus. So in what seems like a purely pragmatic move to secure his own position, he makes a deal with Frederick. He cedes Jerusalem unfortified, except the Temple Mount back to Christian control for 10 years. It caused outrage, but it clearly shows how internal Ayyubid politics were driving decisions, even hugely symbolic ones.
It really underlines the core problem. That family structure just kept fueling internal conflict. Princes fighting princes, sometimes even allying with crusaders against family.
It weakened the dynasty constantly, drained resources, created openings. The system that worked for expansion under a strong leader like Saladin just didn't ensure long-term stability.
After Al-Kamil's death in 1238, things get even more unstable. His son, As-Sali Ayyub, eventually takes power in Egypt, and he leans even more heavily on the Mamluks, doesn't he?
He does, particularly the Bari Mamluks, the ones he housed on Rada Island in the Nile. He needed a force loyal only to him, independent of his unreliable relatives in Syria. This gives him a powerful army, crucial for victories like Laforbi in 1244 against other Ayyubids and Crusaders. But it concentrates even more power in Mamluk hands.
Then comes the Seventh Crusade in 1249, led by Louis the Next of France. They land in Egypt. And just at this critical moment, Sultan As-Sali Ayyub dies.
It's a crisis point. But his wife, Shajar al-Durr, steps up remarkably. She conceals his death, works with the Mamluk commanders like Baybars and Aybak to organize the defense, keeps things from falling apart.
His son, Turan Shah, eventually arrives, and the Mamluks lead the army to another decisive victory against the Crusaders at Mansura in 1250, capturing King Louis.
A huge victory won by the Mamluks. But Turan Shah quickly alienates these powerful emirs who just saved the kingdom. He tries to assert his authority, push them aside.
Big mistake. The Mamluk commanders, led by the Bahars, see him as a threat. In May 1250, they assassinate Turan Shah.
And that's the moment. The Mamluks seize power directly. In a really unprecedented move, they initially install Shajar al-Durr as Sultana.
A female ruler. Highly unusual, but it doesn't last long due to opposition.
Right. Facing pressure, she marries the Mamluk emir Aybak and abdicates in his favor. Aybak becomes the first Mamluk sultan. That's the end of Ayyubid rule in Egypt, the beginning of the Mamluk sultanate.
Ayyubid branches still existed in Syria, though, but then came a completely new threat. The Mongols.
Yes. Hulagu Khans sacks Baghdad in 1258, ending the Abbasid Caliphate. Then they invade Syria in 1259-60.
And the remaining Ayyubid princes in Syria, still fragmented, they couldn't resist.
No. They couldn't unite effectively. The main Ayyubid ruler in Aleppo and Damascus is defeated and executed. The Mongol invasion basically sweeps away Ayyubid power in their Syrian heartlands.
But the Mongol advance is stopped.
Yes, but not by the Ayyubids. It's the new Mamluk Sultanate of Egypt that confronts and defeats a Mongol force at the critical battle of Ain Jalut in Palestine in 1260.
Ain Jalut is huge, right? Stops the Mongols, saves Egypt.
And legitimizes the Mamluks enormously. They emerge as the saviors of Islam, the dominant power, and quickly consolidate control over both Egypt and Syria, replacing the Ayyubids almost entirely.
Though some minor Ayyubid lines survived for a while longer in places like Hama and Hisn Kaifa.
They did, as vassals usually, showing the transition wasn't instant everywhere on the periphery, but the main dynasty was finished.
So the Ayyubids, they rise from, well, relatively modest beginnings through military and political skill under Saladin. They forged this powerful, significant empire.
But one that was also complex and ultimately structurally fragile, spanning Egypt, Syria, Yemen, the Hejaz.
Their legacy is profound, though. Solidifying Sunni Islam in Egypt and Syria, effectively challenging the Crusaders, fostering trade and culture, leaving impressive architecture.
Absolutely. They presided over a period of real economic growth and intellectual flourishing. Cairo and Damascus became major centers.
And they played this key transitional role, didn't they? Rising from the ashes of one dynasty, the Fatimids, and then through their increasing reliance on Mamluks, paving the way for the next major power, the Mamluk Sultanate.
Definitely. Their story really highlights how those internal dynamics, the strengths and weaknesses of that family confederation model, were just as crucial as the external threats from Crusaders and Mongols in determining their fate. And Saladin, of course, remains this powerful symbol of unity and resistance.
Understanding the Ayyubids really does give you a vital key to unlocking the history of the medieval Near East, the whole Crusades period, and even the foundations of later states in Egypt and Syria.
Which brings us to maybe a final thought for you to consider. The Ayyubid state, built on these family ties and military assignments, achieved incredible things but ultimately fractured because of that very structure. What lessons might we draw from that about the inherent tensions between, say, decentralizing power to effectively manage a large, diverse region and maintaining enough central control to ensure long-term stability? Something to think about.